Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we have a panel discussion co-sponsored by the Center for International Relations and the Institute for the Study of Conflict, Ideology, and Policy at Boston University. The discussion is titled, War in Iraq, How's It Going? And features Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs, Peter W. Rodman, Senior Advisor to the Secretary of State and Coordinator for Iraq, Ambassador James Jeffrey, and Director of Operations for the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Lieutenant General James T. Conway. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Director of the Boston University Center for International Relations, Professor Hussein Haqqani.
Let me begin by saying that the discussion about the war in Iraq arouses a lot of passion. The media generally, and those of us who also have any relationship with the media and discuss the media, realize that the media often generates a lot more smoke than fire, or a lot more heat than light. And so, therefore, it's important for our students to hear different points of view. Some of you will probably go back home without changing your minds, which is perfectly fine with me, and hopefully with your own conscience. And some of you will probably change your minds on the basis of information that is available to you. But the purpose of a university should be to give people an opportunity to have access to different sets of facts, different sets of opinions, and then the ability to sift through them. So with that, I will invite Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs, Peter W. Rodman. He is responsible for advising the Secretary of Defense on the formulation and coordination of international security strategy and policy in East and South Asia, the Middle East and Persian Gulf, Africa and Latin America. So he has to deal with policy in more regions than most of you are studying. And I trust that he will be giving us the broad overview of the war in Iraq from the point of view of the Department of Defense. So, Peter Rodman, please.
Thank you very much. First of all, I want to thank Boston University for hosting this event and thank the Center and the Institute for co-sponsoring it. The two colleagues who came with me from Washington today, Ambassador Jim Jeffrey and General Conway, have spent a lot of time on the ground in Iraq. So they know Iraq intimately, and they can discuss these issues in some detail. What I'd like to do is just say a few words to put all this in context. First of all, our strategy to win this war, and then what is at stake. Now, since last November, in a series of statements and speeches, the President has been laying out in some detail the national strategy that we have been pursuing. Now, the strategy is political and economic as much as it is military, maybe more than it is military. And these elements, political, economic, and military, are all interconnected. The political dimension, as I said, may be the most important of all, because the core of our strategy, and in fact the reason we went there, is to help the Iraqis build and consolidate their own new institutions, filling the vacuum left by the demise of the old regime. This is a way to empower the moderates in Iraq, the mainstream people in all of the communities who represent the overwhelming majority of the Iraqi population. Helping them build their institutions is a way to isolate the extremists politically, even as the coalition and the Iraqi forces are hunting them down militarily. The strategic prize in Iraq is that political process. That is what the extremists are trying to derail and disrupt, and it is, by the way, what they have failed to derail or disrupt. We saw last year in 2005 three different successful elections, January 30th, election for a transitional government, October 15th, a referendum on a new constitution, December 15th, a general election under the new constitution. And in that success, we saw the gravitational pull of the political process working on the mainstream Sunni Arabs, pulling them into a political process which they had boycotted at the beginning of the year. Now they want to be in it. And they voted, and their turnout was huge in December. We hope that this gravitational pull on the Sunni Arabs will separate them from the extremists, The terrorists, in our view, the extremists, in our view, are a minority of a minority. And what those elections conferred on a new government that we hope will be formed soon, what those elections conferred is legitimacy, conferred legitimacy on these new institutions that are being built. And that legitimacy may be the most powerful weapon that we and the Iraqis have. Remember a quote from Zarqawi, the terrorist Zarqawi. A couple of years ago, we intercepted a message he was sending, and it was published, and he said, "Democracy is coming, and what will be our pretext? What's our excuse?" Earlier this month, Zawahiri, who's another extremist, the deputy of bin Laden, published a statement on the Internet, and one of its main points was a warning to Iraqis, to Palestinians, to the Arab world in general, to beware of the seductive, what he called the U.S.-led political process. He saw this, said this is a seductive and diabolical diversion from the duty of jihad. He was worried about the Palestinians. Even Hamas might get seduced by this idea of having a legislature, and the Iraqis he mentioned as well. He was very nervous about all of this democracy stuff because it goes directly against what the extremists are trying to do, which is to disrupt and destroy. And that is what the struggle is all about. Now, the economic dimension is, of course, about demonstrating to the Iraqi people that these new democratic institutions can improve their lives. We all know that Iraq has enormous economic potential. So the terrorist strategy is to perpetuate hardship, to demoralize the population, to discredit democratic government. And the violence is directed at that, and the violence is part of the problem in getting the economy back on its feet. But the economy also suffers from over 30 years of socialist mismanagement and Saddam's twisted priorities. Saddam's Iraq was the second biggest oil producer in the region, but he diverted millions of dollars to weapons, palaces, and corruption. General Conway will talk about our military strategy broadly and in specifics. He can talk about the success of coalition operations and of the success of the training program. Because the training program is of particular importance because ultimately Iraqis need and want to take over the responsibility for their own affairs, including security. We're satisfied with the pace of with the success of operations and the progress of the training program. But the president has made clear that we will set no artificial deadlines for our withdrawal. The president will retain the flexibility to do what it takes to defeat the enemy and build Iraqi forces to take over responsibility. Any reductions in U.S. forces will depend on our achieving the conditions of success, not on some arbitrary timeline. Now, what's at stake in Iraq? I've said that legitimacy is the most powerful weapon that we and the Iraqis have. And I quoted Zarqawi and Zawahiri on how Iraq's democratic evolution is a threat to their dream of jihad. So it's not a coincidence that both we and the enemy see Iraq as a crucial battleground. It's a crucial battleground in the war that these ideological extremists have declared against us. It is a crucial test of strength in a much wider conflict. Osama bin Laden has said, the Third World War is raging in Iraq, and it will end there, in, he said, either victory and glory or misery and humiliation. Zarqawi has said that we fight today in Iraq and tomorrow in Saudi Arabia and after there the West. So our enemies have grand ambitions to spread their ideology, and they're driven by a virulent doctrine. President Bush spoke about this ideology in a speech last October at the National Endowment for Democracy. But our enemies ought to be asking themselves hard questions about their strategy. They ought to do public forums like this. They ought to go up and answer tough questions in congressional hearings as we all do. Because if they think they're winning, we think they're wrong. I mean, first of all, as I mentioned, the overwhelming majority of the Iraqi people have shown that they want this democratic process. They don't have to like us. They don't have to want foreign troops running around their country. But they do have to want this democratic evolution and these institutions that are being built. And they have shown with their votes that they do care very much about that democratic process, which the extremists are trying in vain to derail. The Sunni Arabs are coming into the game, as I said. So we don't think the extremists are gaining ground either politically or militarily. In fact, they are losing ground. For us, as I mentioned, Iraq is an example of how legitimate political institutions can empower moderates. And it's for this very reason that the president has more broadly identified the United States with a trend of political reform, liberalization, and democratization in the region. So we've seen some, and we've seen some of the after effects of Iraq, some of the reverberations of Iraq's democratic process. We've seen it in Lebanon, in Egypt, Syria, Saudi Arabia, in the Gulf states. There's a Lebanese politician named Walid Jumblat, who is traditionally no friend of the United States. But about a year ago, he told an American journalist, quote, "It's strange for me to say it, but this process of change has started because of the American invasion of Iraq." He said, "I was cynical about Iraq, but when I saw the Iraqi people voting 3 weeks ago, 8 million of them, it was the start of a new Arab world. The Syrian people, the Egyptian people, all say that something is changing. The Berlin Wall has fallen. We can see it," he said. So again, both sides, we and our enemies, see Iraq correctly as a crucial battleground. The outcome in Iraq could determine the face of the Middle East for the next generation. It could determine whether extremists throughout the region feel emboldened or discouraged. It could determine whether their ideology gains momentum or begins to lose credibility. It could determine whether this promising trend of democratization and reform in the Middle East receives a great boost or a serious setback. So history is being shaped today in Iraq. It is one of the most significant undertakings of U.S. foreign policy in many decades. The stakes are enormous. The United States has a strategy, and we believe it's the right one. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Peter. Our next speaker is Ambassador James Jeffrey, who has served as the senior advisor to the Secretary of State and coordinator for Iraq since August 2005. Ambassador Jeffrey's responsibilities include developing, coordinating, and leading implementation of policy on Iraq. I would request Ambassador Jeffrey to put the, shall we say, the diplomatic perspective on the war in Iraq for the benefit of our audience.
Thank you very much, Professor Haqqani. It's an honor to be here. Secretary Rodman has laid out the overall strategy and the importance of the strategy for the global war on terrorism. What I'd like to do is to give you an inventory of what we're doing on these two lines of operation in our strategy, political and economic, where we are today, and some of the hurdles that we see before us that we are working to overcome. And General Conway, as noted, will do the security. But it's somewhat artificial that we're breaking this down with one of us doing security and another one doing political and economic. The role of the U.S. and coalition military, and frankly the Iraqi military, in security, but also political and economic activities, is huge. By the same token, the contribution of the political and the economic tracks to our security goals, be it paying the forces that the U.S. military is helping stand up, be it to drive a wedge in the insurgency and thus reduce the number of people who are laying bombs on the roads, is enormous as well. These things are very closely integrated, beginning with the U.S. Embassy and General Casey's Multinational Force Iraq Command in Baghdad, and all the way up to the top of the U.S. government. On the political track, we have three specific goals. One is, as Peter mentioned, to isolate the Zakawi element and others who simply want to turn Iraq either into a new Saddamist regime, threatening its neighbors, or a Taliban-like platform for the al-Qaeda movement to launch attacks. That is, in our view, a minority of the insurgency. Our second goal is to engage many of those folks outside of the current political process, although more are coming in, particularly with the last election, both Sunnis and some of the alienated Shia elements that are grouped around Muqtada al-Sadr and others, to give them a political perspective and a role in resolving their disputes peacefully rather than militarily. Finally, to build institutions, to build democratic capacities, to build a feeling among Iraqis that the democratic system works. Where we are specifically on that is, as you know, there were elections back in December, and it's more than 3 months since that time. Nevertheless, progress behind the scenes has been made. First of all, it took almost 2 months for the international community, through several different agents, the UN and a special organization that was set up to monitor and support the Iraqi elections, to verify that the elections that were held under awful conditions in the middle of an insurgency actually were free and fair, and that a huge percent of the population, almost 80%, certainly far more than we see in our own elections, participated in it, including huge participation by the Sunni Arabs who previously had not been involved. And this was a huge breakthrough for the democratic process in Iraq and for our policy. So it took quite a while to certify those results. But that was not just an administrative or a judicial issue to make sure that people weren't stuffing ballot boxes. It was an important process for the Sunni Arabs to get used to the fact that, in truth, they are 20% of the population. In our own contacts with them out there, again and again and again, in Baghdad and out where you were, these people thought that they were a majority or almost a majority of the population. In many cases, they were shocked to find out that Baghdad is primarily a Shia Arab city these days. And it takes a while for folks to understand this, and so the election served as a vehicle to communicate and transmit this very important fact. And this is having a huge impact on the willingness of Sunni Arabs to compromise and to engage right now in talks with the other parties in Baghdad. So it's been a little over a month since the elections were certified. Technically, where we are is that the Council of Representatives, the parliament, has had its opening session, and the next step will be to select a speaker, and then by a two-thirds majority, and that's a very important number, two-thirds majority, to select a presidency council, a president and two vice presidents. They, in turn, select the prime minister by unanimous vote, and the prime minister has to be endorsed by a majority of the parliament. That is a fairly typical parliamentary system, with a very, very important exception of this two-thirds majority, a supermajority, if you will, to select the presidency council. And you can't get to standing up a government until you get the presidency council, and thus you can't get that until you get a two-thirds majority. Now, in normal political science, that would be a very awkward system. As we know, we only really have two-thirds majorities in America for treaties and a few things like that, because it's very hard to get. But under the circumstances of Iraq today, it's very important, because what we're striving for is a national compact that brings in all elements, the Kurds, the Shia associated with the clerical parties, the Shia who are secular, and two separate groups of Sunnis, a secular group of Sunnis who are very close to the insurgency, and a more clerical religious group of Sunnis, some of whom are close to the insurgency and some of whom aren't. So that's a very colorful mix of folks, all with different interests, that are all working together to come up with compromise policies, compromise leaders, and a structure to move forward. That's where we are today. We expect progress next month. There is a huge need, as you saw with the attack on the Golden Mosque in Samarra, to respond to the sectarian violence that has bubbled up. The leadership is trying to keep keep the lid on this, but nevertheless, it's very important that Iraqis see progress in this political dimension. That is where much of our focus is today across the board. What are the issues dividing them? First of all, there is the issue of who will be the prime minister. The Shia clericalist, which won approximately 128 seats out of the 275 in the parliament, or almost less than a majority, but certainly they're the plurality, have selected current Prime Minister Jaffery. He won by one vote within the Shia group, so there's a lot of controversy about, or a lot of opposition to him within the Shia group, and all of the other groups have told us and others that they don't support Jaffery. So there's a huge battle going on within the Shia community and among the various groups on who should be the prime ministerial candidate. Nothing will go forward until that will be resolved. That was the case last year when the government was set up after 3 months under similar circumstances. But there are other issues that people are looking at, and these are the issues that go right to the heart of the national compact. What are they? First of all, how federal a state should Iraq be? The UN, in its landmark Security Council Resolution 1546, in laying out a vision for Iraq 2 years ago, stated that Iraq should be democratic, pluralistic, federal, and united. When you take each group within Iraq, you will find that group likes one, two, or three of those four. It's very, very difficult to find a group, any group, that likes all four other than the international community and we. But nonetheless, this is a lowest common denominator. You can't imagine an Iraq that would bring in all of the groups without having all of these components. So the question is resolved to some degree by the Constitution, but it's still being discussed because there's a chance to reform the Constitution again. How federal, how pluralistic, how democracy will work out. Key consideration is, will the Shia in the south be allowed to have a large region similar to the Kurdish region in the north, which was grandfathered from the post-liberation political situation? That's a question that is being debated largely between the Sunni Arabs and the Shia Arabs. Another question is dealing with the past. Countries from South Africa to Germany to today Bosnia and Serbia have had to deal with this problem. How do you deal with the millions of people who were associated directly or indirectly with the Ba'athist Party, which was as totalitarian as certainly the communist or Nazi parties? And that's also an area of contention between the groups. Other issues involve oil, relations with Iran, relations with the Arab community, because not all Iraqis are, of course, Arab, and there is a religious division between Sunnis and Shia. So there are a lot of issues that these folks are working out. What they're doing right now is coming up with modalities on how the government will work. The latest breakthrough was to agree on a National Security Council that would bring leaders of all of the groups in to ensure that everyone still has a voice while maintaining the democratic principle that the winner gets to choose most of the members of the government. So that is where we are on the political process. The second thing I want to talk about a bit is our economic track. The economic track has three goals. First of all, we're trying to restore Iraq's infrastructure and basic services, water, fuel products, and electricity, while also getting oil exports up, because oil exports are absolutely crucial to the Iraqi economy right now. We've had fair success with that. A combination of the decrepit nature of the Iraqi infrastructure and insurgent attacks have impacted particularly on oil exports from the north. But if we can get the insurgency under control, if violence can drop, we think that the Iraqis will have a good basis. This has not been cheap. It's cost the U.S. government, not counting security costs of the Iraqi military and police forces, about $15 billion in State Department money and almost $2 billion in U.S. military commanders' emergency funds to give a jump start to the economy. The economy is relatively stable. Unemployment is not where we would like it to be. It's between 25% and 35%, but most Iraqis do have jobs. In most of the country, economic activity is, the only word to say is bustling. But nonetheless, when the president talks about progress is slow and he talks about setbacks, some of that has been directed to the economic side. In response to that, we've taken several steps. We are working much harder in the field with joint U.S. military, State Department, USAID, other agency, provincial reconstruction teams to get assistance out to the Iraqi provincial governments and the folks in the field. We're doing contracting directly with the Iraqi business community to stimulate them and also to get contracts out quicker. But this, again, is something that we're laying the path for further progress in the future. To sum up, right now, our progress is on the political track, is focused primarily on the political track. That is crucial at this point to stand up a government, to get the sectarian violence under control, to support the security operations, particularly the stand-up of the Iraqi army and police forces, and to move forward with reconciliation. There's a certain inherent contradiction in what we're doing. As Peter pointed out, this is immensely important not only to the Iraqis and to the region, but to the United States and the security of the world, given the importance of the Middle East and given the threats that were so manifest to us on September 11th. On the other hand, our prescription on how to deal with this is, to some degree, have the Iraqis stand up, have the Iraqis make a choice, have the Iraqis, through the democratic process, try to resolve their own problems. This may look like a contradiction, but it's the only way we think we can go forward. We do not believe that we can direct this and that we can return to the role that the British played or that the Turks played in Iraq. At the end of the day, Iraqis will decide what kind of an Iraq they will have. Our job, through economic, political, and security efforts, is to assist those who we believe have the right vision to work with the international community, which is just as concerned as we are that this comes out right, through the UN, through the Arab League, through international aid support, to ensure that the Iraqis understand that there is a good future integrated into the international community if they come up with a good solution. Thank you.
Lieutenant General James T. Conway, who currently serves as the Director of Operations, J3, on the Joint Staff. He has a wealth of operational experience serving at sea in Westpac, in contingency operations off Beirut, Lebanon, in Southwest Asia, and most recently has had two combat tours in Iraq. So I would ask General Conway to begin with his presentation, and thank you for coming.
Thank you, Professor, and thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for the invitation and the opportunity to be with you here today. You'll note right away that I can't match the accent or the dialects of my two compatriots. To continue the baseball analogy, I grew up a Cardinal fan, not a Red Sox fan, but I'm satisfied we'll be able to communicate. I think to understand Iraq, you have to understand what the commander of U.S. Central Command has correctly called the Long War. We have the opportunity, I think, to have a unique vision into the strategy of Islamic extremists, and I'll lay it out for you. It's pretty simple. First of all, they declare jihad in order to mass their troops. Secondly, they are in the process now of going about trying to exercise all Western influence from the Middle East. When that's accomplished by their version, they will then turn on these, quote, apostate governments that have worked with the West and that have not supported the idea of jihad, ultimately resulting in the destruction of Israel. And then they turn to the rest of the world. It is definitely a philosophy that deals with the domination, ultimately, of the entire world. They say it may take 100 years. They're okay with that. But that's the strategy as they have laid it out. Now, it's important that the wars of the 21st century don't necessarily deal with gaining ground and destroying your enemy. We believe that it's much more about perception. And these people have shown a remarkable ability to manage their strategic communications and manage the media in ways that we did not appreciate. I would also emphasize, before I leave the subject, that this is definitely, from our perspective, not a war of cultures, and we can't let it descend into that, and yet these people would like nothing better. Why is Iraq important in all of this? Well, there's a number of reasons. I think the historians, perhaps the professor, would tell you that there have been five previous jihads. In every instance, there has been some degree of Western influence, but in every instance, it has had little impact on the outcome. It has been the moderates in the religion that have eventually decreed that they would stop the nonsense and have retaken the religion from the extremists. Eliminating terrorists, from our perspective, is simply not the solution. They can probably make young terrorists faster than they can be eliminated off the battlefield. So we have to get after the root cause. What's the basis for it all? And how do we deal with that? We think Iraq is central to that, because if I ask you folks today to name what you would consider terrorist-producing countries and point your finger on a map to the center of that area, if you remove your finger, you'd be pointing at Iraq, for all intents and purposes. Iran, Syria, a host of others that are in the region. But we think it's important, therefore, that Iraq survive, that Iraq be turned into a free and in some form democratic society that will serve as a model potentially for the rest of the region and get after some of these ills that we see that are potentially creating young terrorists. I had a professor tell me years ago that there are five things that go about making a successful nation state. Arable land, an intelligent population, an exportable product, a fresh water supply, and a seaport. Well, Iraq has all those things. Iraq is potentially a very rich country. And the people of Iraq know that. And they realize that once the nonsense has stopped, that the quality of life for their children and their grandchildren will truly be something to behold. Last but certainly not least, we think that our activities in Iraq send a signal. There's a great article this morning, by the way, in the Wall Street Journal. If you haven't seen it, I commend it to you. It's called The Last Helicopter. There is a strong belief amongst these religious extremists that sooner or later our country will simply cut and run. They can cite you the history of that. And certainly are continuing with our activities such as they are in Iraq. Seeing through this political process that the ambassador spoke about will send a signal, will certainly show that is not our intent in Iraq or in the continuation of this global war on terrorism. Let me spend just a moment talking about the specific enemy that we face in Iraq. There are a number of different groups and organizations that we label insurgents, but when you distill it all down, it comes down to two basic sets. One we call ACF, Anti-Coalition Forces. The other we call Anti-Iraqi Forces. Now, the Anti-Coalition Forces are those folks, those good Iraqis in some cases, who say, you know, you came here as liberators, we now see you as occupiers. And when they see a U.S. patrol cruising by, they're just as liable to go to the closet and grab their AK-47, take their chance on taking a shot, as they are not. However, if that patrol that's passing by is Iraqi, they may go out and cheer it, because they seek security, they seek stabilization for their communities, and they want to see Iraqis in charge. We think we can work with those people when all is said and done. The anti-Iraqi forces are those extremists who simply don't want to see a free or democratic Iraq. They don't want to see the things that we're trying to do in terms of bringing along the government. And in the end, those people have to be, in some form or fashion, simply eliminated. We don't think that we'll be able to work with them over the long term. Now, their tactics and techniques, their procedures have varied over time. They've tried to get at various what we call centers of gravity. It starts with the intimidation of the population. They can't gain their support. What they can do is intimidate them. And a good Army lieutenant or a good Marine sergeant can tell you in about 2 hours whether or not there is an insurgent presence in a village or a community. If there's not, the people are open and friendly. The children come out and wave and want to play ball. If there is, they're sullen and they're quiet and they're afraid to be seen talking with U.S. or coalition forces. They also have murdered innocent Iraqis, more here recently than before even, trying to foment the sectarian violence. They've attempted to get at our national will by the continuation of the low-level, we'll say, an infliction of casualties on U.S. and coalition forces. They've attempted to destroy the infrastructure, electricity, oil, in an effort to deflate the ability of the government to fund for itself and provide for the things that it has to have as a nation state. They have attempted, and some successes they have had some successes, at assassinating those people who would attempt to bring democracy to the country. And again, more recently, they are now attempting to create militias in an effort to foment against sectarian violence or just make it difficult for the Iraqi security forces. They are formidable, but they've made mistakes. You know, you hear a lot about our mistakes since about 3 years ago now, but they have also made a number of mistakes. First of all, they have not been able to hold terrain. If you look at any successful insurgency over time, it has always held certain areas that it can use to train its forces and use as a base of operation. They attempted that in Fallujah, But your little red book on insurgency by Mao will tell you that you don't take on a main force unit until you're ready. They attempted that in Fallujah and failed. 1,500 were killed, another 1,500 or so captured. Those are people that the insurgency could ill afford to lose. They have failed to prevent the growth and development of the Iraqi security forces. I'll give you a quick example. About 6 weeks ago in the town of Ramadi out in the Al Anbar province, we were recruiting Sunnis for the Iraqi military. At about 9 in the morning, a suicide bomber, a foreign fighter, walked into their midst and detonated himself, killing about 20 and wounding another 40 or so more. Well, they went through the immediate reaction to something like that, did the triage, evacuated the wounded, and carted off the dead. And about 1 o'clock, they got back in line to continue to join the Iraqi military. So in spite of these bloody actions that are taking place, the young Iraqi males in the country understand where this thing is going, and in a lot of cases, they simply want to be a part of it. They failed to provide a proper vision for the Iraqi people. They want to take them back to the 15th century, and they can't offer much by comparison in terms of what a free and democratic society would offer. They have, again, as I mentioned, I think, earlier, failed to achieve popular support. If you look at the bombings in Jordan, if you look at the indiscriminate killings of women, children, etc., that is not a popular thing in Iraq. And, in fact, what we're seeing in a number of communities now is what we call red-on-red, insurgents against the al-Qaeda movement, because they think their methods and their procedures are truly excessive. And lastly, and I think really most importantly, they have failed to stop the political process. We've now had the three elections that these gentlemen have talked about. In each instance, they've tried. In each instance, they have failed. And what's happened in the process is that those Iraqis who were on the fence, waiting to see which way this thing is going to go, are now down off the fence. When their finger went into that blue inkwell, and they declared that they were going to support, against all the threats and intimidation, the idea of an elected government, they are now off the fence. And the terrorists, the insurgents, have dramatically failed to stop that process. Okay, so what is our concept of operations? What's happening with the multinational force in Iraq? The mission statement there is that we seek, the end state would be, an Iraq at peace with its neighbors, an ally in the war on terror, a representative government that respects human rights of all Iraqis, security forces sufficient to maintain domestic order, and to deny Iraq as a safe haven for terrorists. Would you put that slide up now? This is the force structure that General Casey commands in the country that enables him to accomplish that. You'll see currently we have about 132,000 U.S. forces in the country with about 19,000 or so coalition forces. What you see, and that's a fairly constant on the scale, what you see growing dramatically is the size of the Iraqi security forces, those trained and equipped. And that figure today stands at something over 240,000. Now, we have drawn down from a high of U.S. Forces of about 160,000 during the last election. We have drawn down on a fairly permanent basis from 17 brigades or regiments to 15. Subsequent drawdowns will be based on the situation. Both General Casey, General Abizaid, the President have all said that. It will be a determination made by the commander on scene and endorsed or not endorsed, as the case may be, by the National Command Authority. The focus is essentially on what we call five lines of operation. Transition of Iraq to self-reliance in a security perspective, to help the Iraqis to develop this national democratic government that we've spoken of, to help Iraq strengthen its economy, to help Iraq strengthen its rule of law and to promote civil rights, and to increase international support for Iraq. And both military forces and diplomatic forces, all the elements of U.S. power, are working across these five lines of operation to try to ensure that we have a uniform level of progress. Our progress in Iraq is measured by a number of things. One, it's fair to say that we and or the Iraqi security forces have not lost a single engagement to the terrorists. But that said, the insurgency continues. It is now measured by the Iraqi institutions that we support. It's fair to say, if we had a map up here, that The insurgency only lives in four of the 18 provinces. The other have pretty much a daily routine, a quality of life that is equal to or now exceeds what they had in the post-Saddam era. Our military and the coalition forces are providing partner battalions to those Iraqi battalions in the field, as well as training teams, transition teams that will be with them for some time. These young men, in some cases women, live with, eat with, sleep with, and work with the Iraqis. They go into operations with them. They provide for their logistics, and they provide access to American weapons when the case is necessary. We have seen regional states in the area engage their own terrorist cells and have had significant successes beyond what the comparison might have been just a few years ago. We've seen a new concept at work in conjunction with the State Department called Provisional Reconstruction Teams. That's been very successful in Afghanistan and is now being reported or transported over to Iraq. Principally, however, the successes we have seen have been with the Iraqi security forces. Increasingly, the Ministry of Defense is becoming a more professional organization. It still needs some to go, but they are, again, providing the leadership and the chain of command that's necessary for the Iraqi forces in the field. We continue to see Iraqi forces taking the lead in the field against the insurgency. Currently, we have two divisions, 13 brigades, and 50 battalions who own ground, who have taken responsibility for their own turf. And that number increases significantly in some cases month to month. To this point, by General Casey's estimate, we've achieved about 45%, about 75% of our desired end state. Now, in terms of Iraqi security force capabilities, we've heard various estimates in terms of what they're really capable of doing. Are they the 82nd Airborne Division? No, absolutely not. But do they have to be? No, we don't think that either. They simply have to be better than the insurgents. And our training and arming effort is certainly allowing them to do that. There is, I think it's fair to say, sometimes a propensity for U.S. commanders arriving to want to do it themselves. Type A personalities, leading men in combat, they really want to make sure that the mission gets accomplished. But we continually remind ourselves and remind the commanders, that's not your role. As the ambassador said, we can set the conditions, but it's going to be up to the Iraqis to determine ultimate success. Our observation is that there is no lack of courage or tenacity on the part of the Iraqis, the same willingness to fight and die for their country that we saw as we crossed the line of departure 3 years ago is now resident in those same Iraqi armed forces, both the Army in particular, but also the police. My oldest son just recently completed a tour in Fallujah. I'll offer to you his observation. He, in writing me an email about the battalion commander he was working with, said he's a bear of a man, really an easygoing guy with a great sense of humor until his troops make him mad, and then he's really hard to deal with. The operations officer of that battalion, he said, I can't speak a word with the man, but he's a natural leader. And people flock to him because they want to be around him. They appreciate the talents that he has, and the battalion is doing very well. And that is a comparison to his previous tour of duty about 7 months before when he was operating south of Baghdad. I think it's worthy to note that although there are discussions of whether or not we're seeing sectarian strife or on the verge of civil war, what you haven't seen are the Iraqi security forces affected by that. You haven't seen them going to their various camps or fighting each other. You have not seen units dissolve. Indeed, if you look at the elections, if you look at the Samarra bombing, if you look at the recent Arbaeen where we had 3 million people on the road, if you look at, even in the news right now, the attack on the, quote, mosque, or the militia headquarters in Baghdad, Iraqi security forces in every instance are performing to or above standard. In every one of these instances, you don't see a lot about it. But in fact, their morale is zooming because of these kinds of successes. And the appreciation of the people, which has always been fairly high for their security forces, is even more enhanced than before. Let me close with maybe 3 points. One, I need to be frank with you. I've mentioned to you a lot of things that we consider are going well. There are a number of things that we don't think are going so well and that continue to need work. Infrastructure protection. Again, we've got to be better able to protect the oil lines and protect the electrical power that feeds the country. To date, we have simply not been able to do that on a scale that provides a quality of life and progressive growth on the part of the Iraqi economy. The Iraqi factories can't be up and running if they don't have reliable 24-hour-a-day power. And so you don't have jobs where young boys are not able to work in the factories, but instead can make $100, maybe two, for laying the next IED. So those two things are distinctly related. The government formation is slower than we would like. It's been elected now for some months, and we still don't have a prime minister. We really think that once the government is established and it is secular, then we'll see a lot of the nonsense stop taking place right now, where we see sectarian strife in some of the larger cities. Border security. It is not just Iraq, but border security needs to be better. Probably 75% or so of the border forts are now built. They're not all manned. But in order to stymie the cross-border movement of foreign fighters, some of supplies and equipment, we've got to tighten the borders in order to be able to secure the internal of the country. And lastly, the militias are starting to cause a problem. They're starting to grow, and we're going to have to deal with them, because they are outside this normal construct now of Iraqi security forces. The second point I would make is that your generation, I'm talking now to the students, is quite remarkable. We weren't always sure. Some of the old guys call them the joystick generation, maybe a little less discipline, not enough PT. Ladies and gentlemen, they're doing marvelous things, and I would offer that between them and you, our country's in great shape for a long time to come. Let me tell you, they understand what's taking place. They appreciate the fact that what they're doing in Iraq is keeping those would-be adventurous terrorists from coming to Los Angeles or perhaps Boston. So they feel that they are helping to defend the country with their presence in Iraq. They also understand very clearly what the sacrifice is all about, and they are willing to make it. They simply ask the same thing of their countrymen here, and that's a willingness to stay with them and stand behind them. And I suppose that's my last point. A lot of challenges still remain. The fighting is not over, and it will potentially be bloody in some instances. But we can't afford to not stay with it. If you recall again what I started out with, and that's this idea of world dominion booting us out of the Middle East and causing us to cut and run. They feel they can do that, not through defeating our forces in the field. They accept that that's an impossibility. But by chipping away and causing deterioration of our national will at home, there's too much at stake for us to allow that to happen. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Now that we have had presentations from Secretary Rodman, Ambassador Jeffrey, and General Conway, I will open the floor for questions.
Hi, Andrew Basevich. I teach here at Boston University. I apologize for missing the first two presentations, but I was fascinated with General Conway's comment that General Casey says we've now achieved 75% of our end state, and I'd like you to expand on that. And my math says 3 years to get to 75%, one more year gets to 100%, and therefore that would suggest that we could start to liquidate this adventure. So could you talk a little bit more about what that means and how we get the next increment?
Yeah. The percentage references the growth and the training, the equipage of the Iraqi forces, and his belief that if you look at what is intended to be achieved in terms of total numbers, that we're about three-fourths of the way there. Everybody from the president on down has said, as the Iraqis come online, we will reduce troops. And I can tell you, I think, even in this audience, that General Casey, General Abizaid have a series of decision points throughout this calendar year and into next, potentially, wherein they will examine what is the condition on the ground, what is the condition and the continued growth and responsibility of the Iraqi forces, and therefore what number of our forces are needed.
One thing to remember is that goal is to produce a light infantry counterinsurgency force. The Iraqis will not be in any way capable of even bringing the fire support and certain other things that you need for counterinsurgency, such as attack helicopters and such, let alone to defend their country, where you would need more artillery and more mechanized mobile forces, perhaps. So I think that while the training program is at the end of the year, I wouldn't rule out continued U.S. forces to do these kinds of things beyond that.
The contracts with the volunteer army have been breached consistently by telling soldiers who signed up for 3 years that they're going to be sustained and continued whether they like it or not. And that's going to have an effect, and has already had an effect, on the ability to recruit in the volunteer army. Rewards are now offered of, say, $10,000 if you reenlist, and you're going to be continued if you don't, which is sort of a Hobson's choice.
In terms of recruiting practices, retention practices, those types of things, I suppose you can always cite an exception to the norm where people feel like they've been deceived or potentially abused by a policy or a procedure. But by and large, Army recruiting is now pretty good. It had a lapse. They have gone to work on it. They have increased the bonuses. They have increased the numbers of recruiters in the field. And right now, I think it's on its eighth month in a row or something like that, where they have gotten what they wanted to for that monthly quota. Marines have done fine, as have the other services all along. It's interesting. I just heard some stats yesterday. There was a direct corollary between retention and the number of deployments that you do. The more you deploy, the more likely you are to stay. And what that tells me is that those troops who do sign on and put on the cloth of the uniform are pretty satisfied with what they're seeing and what they're participating in.
Well, with that, we come to an end for our forum. I think we have learned quite a bit. My final sort of thought for everyone is that war is about locating the enemy and liquidating the enemy. If we are having problems in locating the enemy, then we won't be able to liquidate the enemy. And that is what the whole problem with the war against terrorism is. Are we producing more terrorists than we are liquidating is the question at the end of the day. And I think we will all be looking for answers in the years to come. Thank you for coming and talking to us.
You've been listening to a panel discussion titled War in Iraq, How's It Going? The featured speakers were Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs, Peter W. Rodman, Senior Advisor to the Secretary of State and Coordinator for Iraq, Ambassador James Jeffrey, and Director of Operations for the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Lieutenant General James T. Conway. Moderating tonight's discussion was Director of the Boston University Center for International Relations, Professor Hussein Haqqani. For a CD or cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15, which includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Vince Fairchild and Michael Garth with help from Glenn Alexander. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.